Welcome back to Unyielded, Thriving No Matter What. I'm your host, Bobby Kaler, and I'm so happy that you've joined us. As the creator and host of this podcast, it is critical to me to convey to you, our listeners, how much positive power you have inside of you right now, in this very moment. You have the power to change your life. And that could be changing it, like I had to back when I was 23, from a place of kind of being on a road to nowhere, kind of feeling hopeless and stuck, to being on a road to somewhere desirable, someplace good. It could also be changing your life from good to great. And it could also be changing your life from great to, I cannot believe how incredibly blessed and lucky I am to get to live this life. You have that power inside of you, and that is all you need to get started. The rest, you can learn along the way. I started this podcast as a way to bring stories of hope and triumph, as well as resources that will help you along that journey, whatever that might be, whatever your starting place is, or whatever your destination might be. My sincerest hope is that you find it valuable. So let's go. Here is this week's episode. My guest today lives to engage with people in meaningful ways so that we can connect with depth and live in a more fulfilled world. He supports humble leaders, those who know they are part of the problems they experience and a part of the solution that they can create, and who intend to put their people and their purpose first. Feeling stifled on his own corporate track, he was introduced to Simon Sinek's work and was immediately inspired by it. He met Simon in 2010 and became the fourth person to join his team. He began by answering fan mail, and then he became the first person outside of Simon to lead his social media efforts. He moved on to hold the roles of chief of staff and head of brand experience and training and development. He led a global team of speakers and facilitators at Simon Sinek, Inc., and he worked to ensure the team's culture, products, and communications authentically reflected the organization's most deeply held values and beliefs. He also had the opportunity to narrate the audiobook for Simon Sinek's book, Finding Your Why, a practical guide for discovering purpose for you and your team. He has led hundreds of keynote presentations, workshops, and leadership development programs, though he still works to share Simon's message, helping to create a more inspired, safe, and fulfilled world. He also works to advance his own thought leadership on leadership, culture, and psychological safety through keynotes, writing, coaching, and advising. He has worked with leaders and organizations around the world and serves clients in any industry where human beings work. He lives in Toronto with his wife and his two young children. His name is Stephen Shedlutsky, and I cannot wait for you to meet him. Well, Shed, thank you so much for joining me here.
My pleasure. Delighted to join you, Bobby.
Hey, I've been looking forward to this. And I thought, as usual, could we just kick off with you sharing a little bit about your story? And also, you know, that I'm not just making up your name here.
Sure. I'm Stephen Shedlutsky. Friends call me Shed, which is why Bobby just called me Shed. And all of you out there, you're welcome to call me Shed. I'm in Toronto, Canada. I'm a dad of a couple young kiddos. And I have a belief that guides me, my career, my life, quite frankly, which is that every single human being, every one of us has strengths. And when we first realize we do, discover what they are, because we can be blind to our own strengths.
Oh, yeah.
A friend of mine likes to say that it's very hard to read the label on the jar when you're inside the jar. And so we all have strengths, discovering them, nurturing them, and then using them to contribute toward a cause bigger than ourselves and bigger than profit. Profit is not a cause, profit is a result. And when we do that, we use our strengths to contribute to something bigger than ourselves, a cause bigger than ourselves. The result is fulfillment. And everything in my life, everything in my career is devoted to that, to the pursuit of fulfillment. And that we do not need to love every, or we don't need to rather like every moment of every day to love every day and to feel that it's worth it.
I like that. Tell me more about the, we don't have to like every moment in order to love every day.
So, well, and this dovetails nicely into a conversation that I've just started to learn more about called toxic positivity. Toxic positivity is this notion that good vibes only. You know, we can only talk about the future and we can only talk about good stuff. And it's become such a pervasive topic, I think, recently and through COVID, is because a lot of leaders are seemingly sweeping the hard stuff under the rug. I mean, there have been many people, myself included, who've suffered from grief. Like there's been loss. There's been loss of a previous life. There's been loss of previous teammates. There's been loss of people through COVID, you know? And so when I say we don't need to like every moment of every day, I mean, if we, Bobby, take a chart of our lives from when we're born to when our to when we die and we chart happiness, like it doesn't just go up. And if it did, that would be quite boring, probably. Part of the beauty and the meaning and the discovery of our lives are the ebbs and flows of when our values are pushed or when things don't go as they should. That's actually how we grow. Otherwise, we kind of wrap ourselves and others into bubble wrap and don't really have a real life. And so, I'm a huge believer that that things don't have to go perfectly well. In fact, when they don't, that's usually when we grow. And that as long as we're doing something that we care about, that there's play, purpose, and potential in, we don't need to like every moment of every day to love it and feel that it's worth it.
Yeah, I completely agree. I haven't read that book yet. I recently, it hit my feed somehow. Do you recommend it?
Which one?
The Toxic Positivity.
I didn't even know there was a book in that title. If there is, cool.
I think there is because it came up on, I want to say I was on Amazon and it hit my, you might like this book, but now I don't know. Now I have to go back and look at it.
I feel like we're like Batman and Robin and we go to the Google, let's find out.
And maybe, wrong.
Yeah, there could be. I first learned about toxic positivity from Susan David, who wrote a book called Emotional Agility.
Okay.
And she speaks about toxic positivity. I haven't seen a book called Toxic Positivity.
Maybe
not.
Maybe it's just something I saw on LinkedIn. Who knows?
Yeah. Oh, it looks like there is a book, Toxic Positivity. Okay. A few of them. Anyway, cool.
Really?
Good talk.
Interesting. Yeah. We learned something already.
Yes. there's yet another book we both haven't read.
I know. Believe it or not, there's one out there.
Lots of them. Yeah. Lots of them.
You know, when I saw that, because I think that I score very high in optimism, right? I am an optimistic person.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, I think that there is, I just remember seeing something. This was like at the heart of right after the shutdown, maybe 3 or 4 months after the shutdown. And it was on LinkedIn. And someone posted, basically, stop whining about having to work from home. Just be grateful you have a job. And I thought, okay. Yeah, you can be grateful that you can have a job.
Yeah.
And it's
I mean,
maybe
so
not
we,
the whole picture.
So, I mean, a few things. I mean, so things I believe in. Yes, optimism. Yes, hope. Yes, gratitude and practices of gratitude. And, you know, the way there's a difference between blind faith and optimism.
Yes.
I think blind faith can be dangerous and ungrounded. And optimism or hope is the belief that there is light at the end of the tunnel, even if you can't see the light yet.
Yeah.
And if you don't feel hope, that's when you really need to phone a friend or speak with someone or do something that can help you reignite or find hope. Because life without hope is not life at all.
Yeah. It can be very dark.
Yes. Now, and when it's that dark, we can do things that we'll regret, maybe, or do things that are destructive to ourselves and others. So we need hope and we need each other. I think if we have hope in each other, we have everything we need.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah. And there's a book. I mean, if you want evidence of this, Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning is a wonderful example of this. A very moving example. And brings to life the epigraph of the book is from Friedrich Nietzsche, which says, with a big enough why, you can overcome any how. Directly to your comment that you saw on LinkedIn, we know that from Gallup, our relationship with our boss, our direct boss, has more of an impact on our health than that of our relationship with our family doctor. And I've got some of those in my family, and I'm very comfortable saying that statement. It's true.
Wow.
And so, you know, sure, be grateful you have a job. However, I have a belief in an equation for culture. Culture equals values multiplied by behavior. And the more power you have in an organization, which is often linked to title or authority, but not always. You can have people who don't have a title, but have influence. Mm-hmm. So culture equals values multiplied by behavior. And typically the more power you have, the more of an impact you have on the equation. Because like, if you or I are senior leaders and we don't behave in line with the stated values, that's a big issue. If you or I are a very junior employee and we don't behave in a way that is aligned with the values, still a big deal, but less of a big deal. And so, which now let's unpack the equation. So you need to be clear in your values. I'm a big fan of articulating values as verbs or action phrases so that we're more likely to do them, right? Like how many organizations have you seen have the value excellence? Cool. Anyone know what excellence means? Nope. Right.
But we all have it.
Right. Excellence to me means do more great work, which mm-hmm. is like, okay, before I press send on this email, is this great or is this good enough? You know? And it's noting when do I need to be greater and when is it good to just go, you know? Or integrity, like do me a favor, more integrity this afternoon, please. It's like do and say, what would be integrity? Do the right thing, especially if it's hard and even if no one's looking. Now we're talking. So now culture equals values multiplied by behavior, which means if you live the values and you're senior or have power, strong culture. If you don't live the stated values, now we're getting in trouble. And if you look at the equation, anything multiplied by zero is zero. And even worse, anything multiplied by a negative is negative, which means if you have stated values or no values at all, and you don't live them, or you have awful values and you live them, you have a negative deleterious culture, which means that when you go to work, whether it's on the computer or in person at an office or a facility or driving a bus or whatever it might be, if there's a negative, toxic, deleterious culture, your day gets worse as you go to work. And so then I would not be grateful for that job. I would recommend you to find a different job or a better leader.
Yeah. You know, when you were talking there about the, when you have your values, the stated values, and the leadership team doesn't lead them. It is
doesn't
like,
live them, yes.
Doesn't live them, right?
Yeah.
It is like multiplying it by zero.
Or negative. It's actually if you have values, of which most organizations do, proudly put onto their website, and if you don't live them or live counter to them, especially if you live counter to them, your values are literally worse than meaningless.
Yeah. They're destructive.
They're destructive or they're deleterious.
Yeah.
And then you lose your people and you lose your customers.
Mm-hmm. You know, you're right. Completely.
Unfortunately, I am. Yes. But this stuff is hard.
This stuff is hard.
And then you throw in scale, which we're not designed for. Which is why I know we were speaking before we put the red light on here. But the middle, particularly in large organizations, matters so much because that's where the rubber either hits the road or not.
Or not. Well, can you speak to that a little bit more? Because I'm completely on the same page with you there.
Yeah. So middle managers are the only people inside of organizations who have what I call multi-directional power or multi-directional influence, which means they have a relationship with someone more senior to them or many people more senior to them, of which they can influence up. And they certainly take orders and are expected to deliver or filter them down. I really encourage middle managers not just to take orders and put them down, to actually understand the orders, to ask questions about them, to say, hey, let me go check that out with my people, because I don't do their job. You know, I've heard of so many people And so many middle managers just taking orders from above, delivering them, not knowing if they're grounded in any reality, and they literally alienate and disengage their people whose boots are on the ground because they're like, have you not been paying attention to anything that's been going on here? Like, yeah. Your orders are so disconnected from the reality of what we see on the ground here. So middle managers can influence up to say, hey, you know, senior leaders, I checked this out with my people, and it's actually not the reality. You know, here's what I'm seeing. Here's what I'm experiencing. I think we might actually need to change our approach. What do you think, right? Middle managers can also influence side to side, and of course they influence down.
Right.
And it's the only place in the organization where there's multi-directional influence. You know, senior leaders wish they had as much influence as middle managers do. And so, yeah, I think the buck, especially with culture and performance, really makes or breaks in the middle in many respects. Even if you have wonderful, well-intentioned, high-performing, high-trusting leaders, you need the middle to translate and make it happen.
Yeah. Well, you said something there too, Shed. They have the ability to influence up.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you get this question a lot, but I hear this a lot. You know, well, how do you go about that? You know, there's always this fear. Any mm-hmm. best practice ideas there that you could share?
In terms of, Bobby, the sort of the infamous question of, you know, I believe in leading this way, but my senior leader doesn't. So how do I get them to yeah. lead in the way that I want them to? And the answer is unfortunately, you can't. I mean, you can lead a horse to water. You mm-hmm. cannot force them to drink. You can drown them, but you can't force them to drink. Pardon, I just made you choke on coffee a little bit. I'd like to say that I'm sorry, but I'm really not
perfect.
That sorry because it was fun. Yeah. So a couple things. One, the tail can wag the dog. The only person you can control is yourself.
That's right.
And so I would behoove you to figure out, okay, these are my values, which you can do on your own or do with others. This is how I want to lead. And then do it. And even better, do it in community. Find other people, whether it's within the organization or a peer group outside the organization as well, and practice this thing called leadership, because leadership is a practice. It's a muscle. And the best amongst us are students. No one's an expert of leadership. And if we commit to leading in the way that we wish we were led, we will create an environment where the people around us and our teams love showing up yeah. and are willing to give us discretionary effort and run through walls with us. You know, the only requisite of being a leader is to have followers, people who willingly go where you're going, not for you, but for themselves. They follow you because they believe that you have their best interests at heart and in mind. And so if you commit to leading that way, and you have enough time, which really, you know, 6 months, 2 years max, your traditional metrics will begin to look better. Your engagement, your quality, your speed. I mean, all of the traditional metrics will begin to look better because I'm a believer that you get the outputs over the long run from the inputs. If you lead or rather drive just by wanting the outputs, you might get them, but that's like not taking your car in for a service and then you're scratching your head when the check engine light comes on.
Yeah.
I mean, we need to maintain the organism, you know, because I don't believe that an organization is a machine. Drivers do that, that people are cogs in a machine and you rip through yeah. them and then you just replace them. You can do that, but it's going to cost you more. Or my experience is that leaders view their organizations as living, breathing organisms. Which is what it is. An organization is not bricks and mortar or the cloud. It's people. And numbers never come to your aid. People do. So I view that leaders view their teams as what they are, a group, a collective of human beings. And when you treat yeah. them as such, you tend to get better results. Senior leaders notice. They go, hey, Bobby, what are you doing differently over here? And you go, oh, we're putting our people and our purpose first. Can we do that? Sure. Can you teach us? Absolutely. Want a promotion? I'll consider it. So the tail can wag the dog. Now, to sort of answer your question head on, we can influence up. Unfortunately, I think we do a bad job of both defining leadership, selecting leaders, and then supporting leaders, either once they're in role or they wish to be in role. So we define leadership too much by title and authority. And being in charge, that is not what the definition of leadership is. The definition of leadership is to take care of those in your charge. Leaders are not born. Leaders are not made. Leaders are chosen based upon the way that they behave. Second is we too often select leaders by performance and not leadership attributes like compassion, service orientation, decisiveness, accountability, care, right? And so we select the way promotions typically work is we go, all right, who's the most driven? Who's the most responsible? Who's got the best performance? Great, let's give them a promotion to lead the team. But they're not fit for the job. They may be a great individual performer, but they don't have the attributes required to actually be a leader. To be a leader, you need to want to be a leader, and you need to want to work on the practice of being a leader, right? Leaders aren't responsible for catching more fish. Leaders are responsible for teaching others how to fish in their own way. In their own way, which is frustrating. Some of the best leaders I've met have had zero prior experience with the jobs that the people that they're leading have, which literally means they have to go and say, hey, team, I literally do not know how to do your job. And so I need to learn and I need you to tell me what obstacles need to be removed so I can go to bat for you. That's leadership. And I see too many people getting a promotion and then they're now in charge of people who were worse at doing the job that they were the best in the room at, which is really frustrating. So it's a shift. And then finally, and worse, there is a 12-year gap between when people get their first management role, age 30, and when they receive their first formal management training, age 42. And it doesn't need to be a multi-hundred-thousand-dollar project. It can be a good book and the right book and a group of people. It can be a leadership development program, can be a book club. And then very finally, just to answer your question head on that you asked probably 8 minutes ago, is, you know, what do you do when you want to influence up? With everything I've just shared, unfortunately, too many leaders who are in role are more drivers than they are leaders, which means that they're, you know, high dominance, high control, be brief, be gone type people. And so sometimes, so long as you feel it's worth it, you kind of need to influence up and make it their idea.
Oh, that's right.
Which is really hard, but as long as you feel that it's worth it, I encourage that you do it. And you just kind of go like, hey, boss, like I've been hearing some feedback from a few people on the meeting that we had last week. Instead of letting these conversations happen in a fragmented way, I had a thought. I wonder if you might like it. Maybe we should just have a team debrief. Instead of us having these separate conversations, wouldn't it be more efficient and effective just to have one conversation? What do you think? Mm-hmm. Well, what's the feedback? I'm not sure, but like, why don't we just have one common conversation so that we can actually, you know, just do it all at once. And maybe we can have a few breakout rooms so it isn't 30 people all at once. You know, what do you think of that? And like, unfortunately, make it their idea.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it can be exhausting.
It can be.
And if you come across my favorite type of leader, which is a humble leader, they'll go, thank you. Tell me more. What can I do better? And unfortunately, too many leaders don't possess or cultivate that humility, which I think is so key.
Yeah. I think humility is incredibly important. One thing I wanted to touch on before we move on to like the, you know, listening, because I, and the speak up culture and that type of thing. When you said that so many managers, it's what, 12 years before they have their first, in my experience, that is so totally true. I can't even tell you how many workshops I've done and the managers come up and they've been in their roles for a long time. And they're like, this is the first time.
Yeah.
That they've made an investment. And the other thing you said there is, it doesn't even have to be a program. Like one of my clients, and this was not my idea, I think it's brilliant though. He took over a region for this nationwide company, and it's a big region. It was the worst performing region. And he took it over and to all of his managers, he said, every month we're going to read another book and we're going to talk about it. And then, you know, some of the classics, turn the region around in 1 year. To one of the highest performing regions. And that's what he did. But it was that working on the self.
Yeah.
You know, it was brilliant. I mean, he's just a brilliant person.
Yeah. Well, so I've both been a participant and then taught or been a facilitator of tens of leadership development programs.
Yeah.
And there's a commonality. Every single one starts with the first module is leading self.
Yeah.
Like you can't effectively lead others until you know your own instrument. And when you know your strengths and blind spots, then you can begin to approach others with their strengths and blind spots as well, which is vulnerability. I think vulnerability gets a bad rap that it's only about the hard negative stuff or weaknesses. It's not. Vulnerability is about exposing both of our weaknesses and our strengths, which makes for good teams.
That's right.
I know when to pass to you. You know when to pass to me. Hey, I'm really working on this and you're good at it. Can you teach me? You know, that's teaming. But yeah, I mean, I don't think it's fair. It's kind of like saying, you know, hey, you want to be a veterinarian? Yeah, sure. Great. Here is a dog, a goat, a horse, and a fish. Like, have at it. It's like, any training? It's like, no, you'll learn on the job.
Don't worry about that.
Yeah. You just need to, you know, mess up a few times. And then, like, and so many new managers and new leaders have no idea what they're doing. So many CEO founders have no idea what they're doing. And I don't think it's adequate enough to say, we're just going to leave you to your own devices and let you create your own leadership development plan. And, you know, I'm also a believer that you ought to pick books that make sense for the team and the organization, because you can, you know, the number of stories I've heard of senior leaders, you know, taking a cross-Atlantic flight and landing and saying, we're doing all these changes. I picked up this book in the airport. It's like, oh no. And, you know, sort of dreading the next time they go on a long enough flight to read a book. So it has to be a book that's, you know,
makes sense.
Well thought of. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, tell me a little bit more about the speak up culture, because I know that's really important to you.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm working on this topic quite a bit right now. And I mean, it's about psychological safety. You know, I like calling it speak up culture. I think psychological safety can sort of put a white lab coat on a very human topic. And so I like calling it speak up culture. What speak up culture is as leaders, you cultivate an environment where people feel safe to raise their hand, share their ideas, share their concerns, and even dissent. Like even privately or publicly say, I don't see it that way. Or can you explain to me how you see it that way? Because I'm not there yet. And I've learned that there's two components to a speak up culture. And I view a speak up culture, Bobby, as if it's a boxing ring. And literally people, you know, open up the ropes and they're like, am I going to do it? Am I going to do it? All right, I'm doing it. And they open up and they jump in and the lights are on them and the pressure's on, whether it's a one-on-one setting, an email, or a public setting.
Yeah.
And there's two components. There's encourage and reward. So encourage is, you know, as someone who isn't the senior leader here, that I feel as though I'm encouraged, that my voice matters and my voice is nurtured. And then once you do feel that it's worth it, taking that risk, that reputational risk, that career risk, the risk sometimes on behalf of others, it's then rewarded. And reward doesn't mean that you make people right. It means that you make their emotions right. If you deny people that their emotions are right, that's the definition of gaslighting, right?
Right.
If you come to me and you say, hey, you know, I got this feedback for you, you know, I felt this, that, or the other, I'm feeling disconnected, whatever it might be. And if I go, no, like, I'm sorry, like, you're not, it's like, that's gaslighting.
Yeah.
That's essentially saying, I'm very sorry to hear you're having that emotion, but that's not the right emotion to have.
Right.
What?
How invalidating.
Right. So reward looks like listen, acknowledge, and tell them to keep it coming, which could be, hey, that's a great idea. I'm having trouble implementing it with sort of what's on our plate or these strategic initiatives, or let me tell you why I don't think that will work. But it's a great idea. Keep it coming, you know? So, you know, we need to reward people for speaking up, not make them be right, but make them feel valued, encouraged, seen, heard, that they matter. I know we're both fans of Zach's work, Mercurio's work, and it's all about mattering, right? People want to be felt as though that they matter. As soon as leaders ignore or punish people, worse, punish people for speaking up, you will bring to life the quote from Andy Stanley, which is quite possibly one of my favorites, that leaders who do not listen will eventually be surrounded by people who have nothing to say, which is the kiss of death.
That's right.
Right. And at its most innocuous, there's missed opportunity. It can lead to failure, or it can literally lead to destruction. We know for a fact that the Boeing 737 MAX 8 disasters, which caused two planes to go down and the death of 346, was a speak up culture issue. There were senior managers inside of Boeing who raised their hand, people who were former military, who said, I have seen military operations shut down for less than these risks. We're moving too quick. The demands are too high. For the first time ever, I do not feel comfortable having my family members fly a Boeing airplane. We need to stop. And they were told, this isn't a military operation. This is for profit. We have pressures. And it's like, what? And that individual chose to resign. And when he woke up to the news of the first plane going down, unfortunately, he wasn't surprised.
No.
Because he knew it was coming.
Wow. When you were talking there, that it's number one, just talk about a high stakes example, right?
Yeah.
I was listening to, it's a podcast, it was put on by the BBC, and it was a series on the Apollo 13 mission.
Yeah.
Gripping. I mean, and I knew, obviously I know the story, right? Mm-hmm. But it was, they had interviews with like Lovell and Gene Kranz. It was just, it was really well done.
Nice.
And at the end of it, they were interviewing people about why was it that it was eventually successful. And one of the things they talked about is that every person could speak up and was expected to speak up. Not that their idea was going to be used, but that was their culture. And I thought that's brilliant leadership.
Yeah. I mean, so a couple of things. So one, and we've all seen the movie and there are some great scenes and what's also good is the movie, though not perfectly accurate to reality, was pretty darn close. And I take your opinion based on that BBC production as evidence of that or not. But I mean, one of the things that was a high stakes, you got a ticking timeline. One of the challenges we can get into is the loudest voice can win.
That's right.
And so leaders are also very good. I mean, one of my favorite things to do in a meeting, Bobby, particularly when I know the people or I'm just learning about them, is I go, all right, who's the quietest in the room? Particularly if I know them and I have a lot of relationship, I'll go, hey, Bobby, you know, we haven't heard from you in a while. And every time you open your mouth, it's always an interesting take. You got anything to add here? Like, we need to do that because then otherwise typically are more dominant, extroverted, sometimes too often white and male voices are heard. And quite frankly, as a middle-aged white male, it's one of my favorite things to do is to call people in. Yeah, and someone who's more extroverted and comfortable speaking up. I take huge pride in going, who probably has something to add here? And then either, you know, if it's appropriate, speaking to them one-on-one and encouraging them to speak up or say, hey, I'm going to call on you. Is that okay? Because I know you have something to add in here is really key. The other is that even if the stakes aren't as high as the Apollo 13 or the Boeing 737 MAX 8, I'll remind us of the Gallup stat that our relationship with our boss has more of an impact on our health than that of our family doctor, which means that if you're like, yeah, but like, I don't work in an environment where if I don't do my job well, the impact is life or death. I regret to inform you that you do. If you are in a role of leadership, your actions and behaviors have an impact on other people's health. Fact. And so if you're a driver, and if you don't create an environment where people feel that it is safe to speak up and share their ideas, share their emotions, share their concerns, you're literally contributing to a negative impact on their health.
That is stunning. That's stunning. I mean, we've heard that for years, you know, in terms of the people don't leave companies, they leave managers. But when you think about it in terms of the relationship with the manager has more of an impact on your health than your family doctor.
Yep.
What are some of those things? How does it impact their health?
So we as a species haven't evolved past our primitive wiring. So we used to live in tribes or communities of 100 to 150 people. As soon as we grew to more than that, we would split off into two tribes. And this is simply just our capacity as human beings. There's research proven by Robin Dunbar that we can maintain about 150 stable social relationships. It's called Dunbar's number. Coincidence? I think not. This is this is the origin of our species. We're a community-based, which unfortunately is why we have so much othering and so much isms and ovias and hatreds and divisions. It's part of our biological wiring, unfortunately, that when we see someone who doesn't look or sound like us, biologically, cortisol is released, you know, danger, threat, until we build relationship and know that it's okay. A bit of a tangent, but my favorite African proverb right now is, I saw you from afar and thought you were a monster. You came closer and thought you were an animal. You came closer and I saw that you were a human being. And when I saw you eye to eye, I knew that you were my family. That's the only way that we are going to make any progress when it comes to othering and division and racism and any of this is when the human in me can see the human in you, because we have far more in common than we have apart. And so long as, I mean, there's a brilliant documentary by Dia Khan called Meeting the Enemy, where she literally, as a Muslim woman, went with the modern KKK, and she happened to be with them in Charlottesville when Charlottesville happened. And based upon developing one-on-one relationship with some very senior people in the White Nationalist Party, she turned them, because so many people who hate others typically have no relationship with others. And so we need that relationship to actually make any progress. And we don't make progress when we call people out. We make progress when we call people in. We need to form more relationship and more love. Yeah. It's the only way ahead. I forget what the original question was, but it was a good one. What were you asking about? You're asking about, I got onto Dunbar's number and I forget why.
Why were even, it was so good though. I was writing down what you were saying. Oh my gosh, I have no idea.
Rewind the tape. We were talking about, I forget. But yeah. I mean, it's just this notion, again, that we aren't designed for scale.
Yeah.
Which again is why middle managers matter.
That's right.
Because the only way to scale leadership is you can't. It's just one leader at a time. You just need to create a greater pipeline of more leaders.
Yeah.
A greater chain of more leaders.
Yeah. The thing
of people who understand the responsibility of what it means to be a leader.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing about relationship, that was huge, you know, in what you were saying there. So I got totally caught up in that. Sorry. No, yeah, that was great.
Obviously me too. Yeah. Well, but yes, but we were talking about how the impact of being a leader matters to people's health. And it's true. Oh yes. Cortisol. Okay. Yes. Now I remember. So essentially you were asking, well, why is that the case?
That's right.
Why is it the case that our relationship with a leader can have more of an impact on our health? So I started by saying that we're a tribal species. We form relationships in sort of pods of 100 to 150, which is why if you ask someone, how many friends do you have? And they say 4,733. I didn't say Facebook friends. I said friends, stable social relationships, people who you know their name, you know why you know them. And some of us can maintain about 250 of those. Some of us can maintain about 100, but the median is 150, which is why like some people fall out of your life, you know, and then you reconnect with them or not. But like, we can't have relationship with thousands and thousands of people, which is why when we say numbers like 7 billion or 8 billion, or I care about all 20,000 people who work here, you can't, like you biologically cannot. That said, when we have a relationship with someone and we do not feel psychologically safe and we do not feel like we can raise our hand and be authentic and be honest, we feel as though, uh-oh, if I say the wrong thing, I could get fired. And we haven't evolved more. Like when we feel like we're going to get fired, we literally feel like a saber-toothed tiger is going to eat us because we haven't evolved. So That's we right. equate being fired oftentimes to death.
That's
it's
right.
just our biological wiring. And so if we don't feel safe, or we don't feel like we can let our guard down, if we don't have trusting relationships with the people above, around, and below us in the organizational hierarchy, there's cortisol in our veins, which I'm now getting all neurosciencey on you. But when we have higher cortisol in our veins, cortisol is the fight or flight. Cortisol is danger. Ooh, fight, flight, or freeze. And yes. then once you remove yourself from the perceived danger, cortisol comes down, we take a deep breath, and we're okay. But if cortisol is consistently in our system, that if we feel like if we say or do the wrong thing, it's going to result with a pink slip, or our reputation is ruined, or we'll never be able to get another job, that literally impacts our health. It makes us more susceptible to the addictive nature of dopamine, which is released in our cell phone, Instagram. Alcohol, nicotine, most drugs, food, all releases dopamine. Gambling releases dopamine. And it makes it harder for us to keep oxytocin and serotonin in our system as well. Serotonin is confidence. It's the leadership chemical. And oxytocin is service orientation, helping others and giving and receiving.
Yeah.
And so there's a neurochemical reason as to why our relationship with our boss has an impact on our health. And it's cortisol.
Yeah. I heard someone describe the cortisol once as when it floods your system, and you don't have enough of the serotonin and the oxygen, you know, it's like you're running at the red line and there's no way to let the pressure off.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a great image for me, you know?
Yeah. And then you crack or you explode. Blow, right? Yeah. Yeah. Totally. You know?
Question I wanted to make sure we talked about this because we talked about this in our pre-conversation.
Sure.
But there is I don't know if it's a quote. I think it is a quote. I don't know who said it, but it's something like the biggest concern is when passionate people become quiet.
Well, it's a quote from Tim McClure. He used to be a senior leader at the company that owns Ray-Ban. I forget what company it's called, but he's a local Toronto guy and wonderful. But yeah, the biggest concern for any organization should be when their most passionate people become quiet.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which means from my point of view, it means that senior leaders are now getting in the way.
Oh.
People who were previously passionate, if they're no longer passionate, I mean, typically it's because if you're passionate, it means that you care about the team, you care about the organization, you care about the product or service so much so that you're willing to make a reputational risk to speak up and speak out. And if those people become silent, that's a big issue and points to me that there's a leadership and culture issue.
Yeah. Well, completely. It seems like it connects back to the speak up culture, right? Because even if you have a dissenting voice, I remember when I was in grad school, David Cooper Ryder was one of my professors. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar with him, Appreciative Inquiry.
No. Okay. Yes.
Amazing. And he said it this way. He said, the loudest complaint is an unmet wish. And I thought, if we can frame that way as a leader, like if someone cares that much, to your point, that they're going to have the courage to speak up, why would we not listen?
Yeah. This is from Admiral Bill McCraven, who said that bad news never gets better with time. And so he trained his people, and he was a very senior military leader. He trained his people. If I'm the emperor wearing no clothes, please let me know, and let me know sooner rather than later. I ask, you know, I'll let you know that I don't have zero ego. So I ask you to be, you know, at least respectful or to do it with diplomacy, but let me know, you know, and I think it's really important, you know, leaders set the tone. So if you speak up and share something truthful and unpleasant with a leader, right? And I've been taught that if it triggers you, it's probably true. And we use probably to be nice, right? Mm-hmm. If someone gives you feedback and you get triggered, it's because they've probably pointed something out that you're not so proud of, which means, I mean, this happens all the time in my relationship with my wife, right? Because we know each other so well and she'll say something and it hits me the wrong way because it's true, right? Which is like, okay, that's where the work begins, right? Mm-hmm. Which is like, I'm like, oh, that makes me upset. And it makes me upset probably because you're right. Just give me a bit of time to like breathe, you know, and let's have a good conversation when we're both ready. But if leaders yell at and demean their people, only sometimes you have a culture in which leaders yell and demean people. It's not binary. It is binary. It is binary. It isn't a spectrum because leaders are purveyors in expectation. Right? Leaders need to behave in ways that's expected. This is what your brand is. And if you behave in ways that are volatile and inconsistent and unpredictable, people don't know what to expect of you and at particular times. And if it's like, I don't know if I should share that feedback with them, because if I do, they might chew my head off like they've done with so-and-so, or I heard they, you know, well, they did it to me once, you know?
Yeah.
And I've had that experience with leaders where I've seen them do it to others, or I've heard them yell and demean others privately or publicly, but it's never happened to me. So I always made it, you know, the other person's problem until it finally happened to me. And I'm like, oh, wow. The only thing in common with that person and all of their behavior is them, and they need to work on it. I just can't force them to.
Can't force them. No.
Cannot. Nope.
Wow. Now, I know that you shared earlier that you're working on a book.
Yes.
Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So I'm working on a book right now. The working title is Speak Up Culture, Why Leaders Need to Truly Listen If They Want People to Step Up. And a lot of what's been in this conversation, I'm working into the book, and I'm organizing the book as sort of, you know, what got us here? You know, why are we in a state where the pervasive view of leaders is that they suck? But leaders don't wake up in the morning and they're like, I'm going to suck today.
They don't want to.
No, they don't want to. And I think it's a definition, a selection, and a support issue, as we discussed earlier. And then, you know, what is a speak up culture in psychological safety? How do we cultivate it? What's the responsibility of leadership? And giving people very, you know, practical ways to have these types of conversations and very practical things that can be done, like speaking last, asking questions, how to deliver and accept feedback, you know, effectively. And by feedback, it can be constructive and positive.
That's right.
You need to be specific, you know, as opposed to just saying great job. Like, people can't repeat great job.
No.
You need to go, here's what you did. Here's what was great about it. Keep going. All right.
That's right.
I can do that. And similarly on constructive feedback as well. And I'm going to end the book with hope for the future and talk about how, you know, I don't really care about business. I care about people. And it's going to be a philosophy book disguised as a business book.
Nice. I love that. And I love too the practical things that people can do. Because we've all heard it like, oh, make sure you listen, or, you know, you need to accept feedback. But how? This is what people are missing. They're missing the how, I think, a lot of times.
Yeah. And there's a reason why multiple books are written on a subject, which is because there's no one size fits all, especially when we get into the messiness of what it means to be human. And so I'm going to include a lot of stories, and I'll include some practical and tactical things, knowing that not all things will work for all people in all scenarios, but I'm hoping to offer at least enough that will be helpful for enough people in enough scenarios.
Yeah, I think that's awesome. And now I have to ask you this too. Why is listening so important to you?
Ooh. So there's a couple of things that come to mind. So one, listening is a skill. You and I could go to a listening class, and at the end of 2 hours, we could be better listeners. What isn't a skill, though, and what is an attribute, as my friend Rich Devinney would say, who's written a book called The Attributes, compassion, for example, or care or empathy, those are attributes. And you can't teach or train or learn those ones. You have to go on a hero's journey. You have to want to develop those attributes. And then you have to put yourself in experiences. Like, if I want to become more patient, I need to do things that will flex that patience muscle. Like, instead of going to the self-checkout at the grocery store, pick the longest line for a cashier, or have children. That's great for patience. I thought I was patient until I had children. Turns out I'm really not. And so one, I think it's worthwhile distinguishing that I know people who have great listening skills, but they don't have compassion. And that can be like giving someone the atom bomb, where they have the skills, but they can misuse them and even use them manipulatively, which is dangerous. So you need the positive intent. Leaders own their impact, whether it's intended or not. Yeah, leaders own their impact, whether it is intended or not. And if you have an unintended impact as a leader, great leaders are still curious and humble enough to care about that, which is really hard work. So, but the real reason listening matters to me so much is born of personal experience. So I grew up with a stutter. I still do have one. I married a speech therapist. Great choice, both for me and my kids. But I remember particularly as a kid, teenager, and young adult, I mean, I was petrified to speak up. I was petrified to have the spotlight on me, even though I was quite gregarious and fun and like liked to engage people. But I literally wouldn't raise my hand, even if I knew the answer in class, for fear of the embarrassment of not being able to say a word, because it happened to me. And so I'm a big believer, Bobby, that our purpose lives in what are we overcoming, or what have we overcome, particularly as young people, and then how, but at any time in our lives, truly. And then how can we help people work through, overcome, and transcend through those same experiences? And so for me, I felt like I was voiceless. I had one really bad teacher who kind of gave me a really embarrassing moment. Not that they knew what was going on, but I never wanted to feel that way again, where I was worthless. And so listening for me, and listening with compassion and sincerity, is the gateway to making people feel as though they matter. When people feel as though they matter, they will shine and they will do remarkable, wonderful things that make you proud because you were a small part of it.
Yeah. I think that's so powerful. It's just so powerful. And I know we're just about at time. Do you have time for one more question?
Yeah. I'm good. Thank you.
Okay.
Yes.
When you said that you believe that purpose lives in what we are overcoming or what we have overcome.
Yeah.
Can you just say a little, I love that. And I believe it to be so true, but could you just speak to that a little bit more?
Well, it's step 12. So, you know, so many people know the infamous famous 12-step program that Alcoholics Anonymous employs. We all know step one. Sometimes you make a joke of step one. Admit that you have a problem, right? But it's important. Like, you can't grow unless you're like, gosh, I need to grow there. And I fully admit I don't know steps 2 through 11 off by heart, but I know step 12. And AA knows that you will not beat the disease of alcoholism. And by the way, there's no beating. There's no beating it. You are always overcoming. But step 12 is service. Step 12 is the commitment to take what you know and to give it to another, to share. And so, yeah, that's truly, what is it? There's the quote around, what is it around like giving it away? That like the purpose of life is to find what you're wonderful at doing and then give it away to others. Give it away to others. It's what makes us remarkable as a species. Not that we're great as individuals. It's that what we can accomplish in community and with each other. We're a service-based animal. It's how we work at our best.
Yeah. Love that.
So, and it's why I have such a vendetta against these leaders who are authorities who divide us. The responsibility of leaders is to bring people together, to point to the future and say, this is the positive that we want to create, and to encourage people who want to do that. And if people don't want to do that, that's okay, but don't punish or divide. That's destruction. That's not contribution.
No, and it's painful. It's painful to see and to observe. So I want to thank you. How can people get in touch with you, or how can they learn more about what you're doing, the book, all that kind of good stuff?
Yeah, thank you. And such a treat to join you. I hope this conversation helps your audience.
Oh, awesome.
Cool. For the time being, I'm the only Stephen Shedletsky in the world. So all you Shedletskys out there, no one name their child Stephen, please. I'm most active on LinkedIn. So if you search for me on LinkedIn, or you can drop in a link, that's where I'm most active and most accessible.
Okay. And I'll put that in the show notes. And yeah. And you have some great content on LinkedIn. I think, well, that's how we connected, through Zach. And I think it was Joe. So yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it. And I know that there's a lot of value in here as well.
Thanks, Bobby. Such a treat. Look forward to the next.
Nice. I hope that you enjoyed that conversation. I know that I was scribbling notes the whole time. This is always difficult, but here are my three insights for thriving. Number one, I loved Shed's advice to articulate your values as verbs, as actions that you can take. I think that this takes something that can feel conceptual and it turns it into something that is tangible. Number two, leaders own their impact, whether the outcome is intended or not. This one really stuck out to me because I think about how this applies in all areas of our lives. In some fashion, we are all leaders. Are we truly owning the impact that we have? Or do we sometimes use the, well, that's not what I intended, as kind of an easy way out? It pains me to say this, but I know that I have. It makes me think about, if we are really living our lives in a way that is important to us, is it fully aligned with what we value and who we believe ourselves to be? There's a great quote by Disney that I saw, I don't know, nearly 20 years ago. And it's that we judge ourselves by our intentions, others judge us by our actions. I keep that quote handy as a reminder to test if my actions are matching my intentions. Because if they aren't, then it's time to change. And finally, insight number three, our purpose lives in what we are overcoming or have overcome, and then carrying that message to others. I've heard this called the hero's journey. And when I think about purpose this way, it makes me kind of emotional. And I know that's a big shocker, but it does. And I think what I love about it so much is that it gives our experiences and our challenges a bigger purpose. I've always said that I don't think that God is a practical joker, that he just likes to throw things my way. I think that there is a reason for every experience that I've ever had. I first felt this way when I was 14, and my mom had had a very bad day, and she had flown into a pretty terrible fit of rage, and I had to run and I had to hide, and I was terrified. I mean, I was 14. It was scary. And as I was hiding, I remember asking God, why? Why is this my experience? And the answer that came back to me was that it was to prepare me so that one day I could help others. To this day, I can still remember the peace that settled over me when I thought about it that way. And to this day, it still keeps me motivated. I'm sure that you all probably had different takeaways as well, and that's fantastic. If you did, I'd love it if you reached out to me and shared what your takeaways were. I'm always curious and I'm always looking to learn more about what you all find valuable. As always, I just want to thank you for tuning in and for listening and for all the support. If you found the episode valuable, and if you know of someone who would find this episode interesting or helpful, I hope that you'll share it with them. Who knows? It could be just the thing that they need today. And today, I'm going to leave you with something that Shed said. Leadership is a practice. So as you go about your week, how will you practice your leadership?